because the devastation is so great that when I started getting pictures from my hometown, you need to start looking, because in some of those pictures, it just looks like a bomb went off.
That's Jose Marti. He lives in Kansas City, and he was on this program at the end of September talking about the destruction Hurricane Maria caused to the place he was raised, Puerto Rico.
It is has drastically changed how Puerto Rico looks. And then you start thinking about, hey, I remember my trips to the rainforest. Well, it doesn't look that way anymore. I mean, there's not a single leaf on any of those trees. The entrance to what is called El Portal in El Yunque is just, it looks like a scary movie.
That was 10 weeks ago, almost to the day. Relief and recovery efforts have gone on basically nonstop ever since. Governments, nonprofit organizations, families, and volunteers all working, and not just in Puerto Rico, but in other Caribbean islands and in Houston after the hurricane there, in Mexico City after the earthquake there in September. The news has mostly moved on, but for many in Kansas City, this story of trying to get things back to normal or figuring out what normal is now is still very much at the forefront. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR Central Standard, we're checking in with some guests we've talked with before to find out how their families, their hometowns are doing, and what is left to be done. Jose Marti, who you just heard from, is here. Jose, welcome back.
Thanks.
We're glad you're here. Where is your family now?
My dad, and we gotta probably talk specifics. My dad is currently in Puerto Rico. He came to Aberdeen, Maryland to be with my sister and his wife, my mom, for a week. So the family is kind of split at this point.
Okay. Your mom stayed in Maryland?
My mom left the island probably 3 weeks after Maria. And for the most part, to take care of the grandkids. She took the grandkids with her just because of schools were not reopening in time. The family, probably like the rest of the population, had concerns about losing the semester, losing school. My nephew is on third grade, and so rapidly he was enrolled in school in Aberdeen, Maryland.
Yeah.
And so my mom is over there while my sister is back, stay back in Puerto Rico figuring out work and reconstruction, I guess.
Yeah. It must be hard for the family to be split up at a time like this with young kids at home.
Yeah, it is actually sweet and sour, because a lot of people who's been in diaspora for a long time, well, they had family members now living with them. You know, some of those houses now have added 4, 5 even more members to their family.
Yeah.
So there is some something happy about that, something sad, because I know stories about some other friends just sending their kids the same way to stay with uncles, aunts, to try to at least have the kids some stability or a normal life.
Do you think they'll ever go back? I mean, will that kind of stability ever be part of the family story in Puerto Rico again?
I think that's going to be the biggest challenge of reconstruction. It is easier to put brick and mortar back, buildings together, probably patch the roads, than try to bring students who are getting established and, you know, getting to know the system, learning the language, getting used to where they at. It's really hard, especially, I'm going to say, for kids and teenagers to say, hey, you know what? I've been here for a year, 2 years. I'm going to go back.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a really tough question.
And the answer isn't known yet.
No one knows yet.
Yeah. When you spoke with us back in September, you talked about just how devastated everything looked from what you were seeing. We heard you just call it a scary sight, almost like a horror movie or something. Have you been back to Puerto Rico since then?
I haven't been back. I'm planning to be there probably in a month and a half from now. It was supposed to be a festive event, and it's still going to be, but we're going to start kind of like still doing probably a 3 or 4 month assessment. Personally, I want to go around and see what's happening, and I'm not sure what I'm going to be looking at even 4 months after.
Yeah, what you're comparing to and what you're hoping to see.
To my memories, to my pictures. The good news is we've been getting some pictures. I've been even though Puerto Rico probably has been a little bit out of the news cycle in U.S., the people in the diaspora, we kept reading the news. We keep looking at Twitter is a good source of information from local independent journalists where you can get a localized, even almost by town, by region. So we're going to start looking at that point in time, how it looks, how fast it recovered, how the recovery efforts are happening, because it is a long recovery effort. It's not going to be a, and we talked about that 2 months ago, mm-hmm. that it wasn't going to be a 1 month or 2 month.
This is a long-term project.
Long-term project.
Well, I want to talk more about that project and how it's going and how your family is experiencing it. But I also want to welcome Amy Duke back with us. She joined us about 12 weeks ago, not too long after Hurricane Harvey had brought devastation to the Houston area. She lives here in Kansas City now, but she's from Houston. She has family there. Amy, welcome back to you.
Thanks, Brian. Good to be here.
So you've been down to Houston since the hurricane, right?
I've been twice. I went the week after Harvey happened to help with those immediate recovery efforts. And then I just went back for another week over the Thanksgiving holiday.
So what has that been like to go back to this place? Was it your childhood home? So is that where your memories are from there?
Yes and no. So it's my childhood community, the neighborhood that I grew up in. The homes that were immediately impacted in my family were my grandmother's home, which I have lived at as a child and again as an adult right after college. So it really is sort of my childhood home.
So what was it like to get back and see these familiar and probably very special places to you in such bad shape?
So it's such a different landscape from what you were just talking about, because it doesn't look like a bomb went off. Houston is subtropical, so it's sort of lush and verdant at this time of year compared to Kansas City. So you land and everything's green. But the weird thing is you enter the parts of town that were flooded is that the ghost of Harvey is very much there. If you look at people's front yards, for example, the front half has like this white ghost-like quality, all the now dry sheetrock dust mixed with shards of glass and nails and other materials. So there's a presence, but it's a little more hidden.
You mentioned your grandmother living there. How is she doing?
She's an optimistic person by nature, but it's definitely visible that this is impacting her, and I think it's impacting her memory. She'll be 94 in a couple weeks, but you wouldn't know it. She operates like a woman in her 70s. But I kind of liken her experience to the film Memento, where she sort of wakes up and it's like her
the person immediate... has to the character has to put together the past from clues in the present.
That's right. So the protagonist in Memento has a form of short-term amnesia. So she wakes up in an unfamiliar place. Her routine is disrupted. She doesn't know where anything is. All of her belongings are sort of dispersed across multiple family homes and a storage unit.
You said the ghost of Harvey is visible everywhere. Mm-hmm. What do you mean? Give me an example of that.
I guess the example is that sort of white ghost-like sheetrock dust that you see in everyone's front lawn. It's a physical presence or manifestation of it. Yeah.
You know, I honestly can't remember the last news report I heard about Houston. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry to say. How easy is it for you to keep track of the recovery effort going on there?
You know, we were talking in the green room about how it changes day to day. And so when we spoke with you all on Friday, we were in a more precarious position, not knowing if the city was going to grant my grandmother a permit to do her repairs. Because it's sort of like when you are in a car accident, and if your car is totaled, then you don't repair your car, right? So if you're in a floodplain and the repairs exceed 50% of the value of the structure, not the land, so you have to separate out those things. So there's a lot of like digging and investigating and waiting on hold, and one person tells you to be in touch with another person and so on.
One of the things that strikes me as a contrast with what we've seen in some of the Caribbean islands, for example, is that Houston has in many visible ways returned to normal. I would think that a lot of the damage and the things that continue to be problems are a little more hidden from view.
I would say that's true if you look at the city on the surface. And it was around 130,000 residences that were flooded. So that's a huge number, but in a city of 4+ million, that's not a huge number. So it's really kind of neighborhood by neighborhood. And other members of my family, life is totally normal, except that they're part of my grandmother and my cousin's home also flooded. So part of that support system.
Well, I want to talk more about that, too. Jose, back to Puerto Rico, one of the things we do hear about is the effort to restore electricity to the island. I checked this morning, and the reports are that something like 32% or a little more of the island is still without electricity. Has that affected your family or the people who you know?
Everyone was affected. It was a total blackout. Everyone lost power, and you got to look at it on, okay, if you have a highway system, right, and if you have access to 71 Highway, 435, well, if you block your access to one of those highways, you can probably restore the flow of people moving through other ones. But when you lose all the major highways in the power mean, right, in power industry, it is really hard to get that back on. And, you know, day by day, you keep looking at the numbers. You know, it's like in the morning, what is the percentage now? And, yeah, the government is, they issue numbers every day, and they look at around 50 or 60% of power generation. Now, that doesn't mean much for customers. If you're a resident, does right. your house has power? Probably not. That
right.
doesn't mean
if
much.
If your house has 0% power, it really doesn't matter that there's 60% in the rest
exactly.
of the country.
So people are estimating around probably 30, even 20% of yeah. residents having power.
Which leads me to wonder, I mean, I can imagine going a few days without power, maybe even a week or two without power. How are people coping, to your knowledge, with going more than 2 months without power?
Puerto Rico's running on power generators right now. A lot of businesses, they had to make an investment and try to get a diesel generator. Personally, I had to send a small one to my parents to have the house running, you know, the essentials. You're not going to go back to comfort. You probably won't have the AC running, but at least the refrigerator. You probably want to have, you know, radios, TVs, mm-hmm. Just the minimal stuff to try to make it normal.
Are generators fairly readily available? I mean, are most people able to get access to at least that much power?
They were not. I mean, during the first couple of weeks, it was really hard first to get the shipments out there. All major companies were not delivering anything. And whatever was in stock in the island, that one, you know, ran out pretty fast. You had people making really long lines to get power generators and anything they could get their hands on, doesn't matter if diesel, natural gas, anything they could get on their hands on just to have their house power. And some businesses are still running. I was looking at numbers. Even all the cell phone companies, they are running, all their towers are operating off diesel generators right now.
Mm. I guess I'm curious for both of you. You both have these deep connections to these places that experience this, but you watched it from afar. You could sit in your relatively comfortable living rooms here and talk on the phone or see it on TV. Is that actually harder in some ways to not be able to be present in the place where this is happening, Amy?
Yeah, it's in the abstract, right? And so you don't have the full sensation of what your family members are going through, which is why it was important for me to get down there as soon as I could and spend as long a period of time as I could. And I've been able to do that twice. And each one has its own phase. So my grandmother has moved into a rental home. So wasn't planning to help her move again over Thanksgiving holiday, but ended up doing that. So it feels good to be able to help in a physical and direct way when I'm down there.
A lot harder to get to and from and around Puerto Rico.
And looking back at, okay, in the first 3 weeks, so you're looking at the snapshot in time of what's happening. And I'm going to be honest, yeah, you're going to the supermarket here and you find everything. And every single time you're like, wow, my parents right now, they can't buy meat. They mm-hmm. don't have fresh produce there. You know, everything is canned if they can find it. And the problem is at that point in time, you don't know if that's a snapshot or if it's going to be how long, 6 months, 5 months. For the most part, yeah, probably fresh produce is not, you're not going to find it on the supermarkets.
But for you being here while that is happening.
It was tough. It was tough emotionally, I'm going to say it. It was really stressful. And I know we talked to the community members, Puerto Ricans in Kansas City and friends, and it was the same way, you know, it was. You just hug each other and you don't say much because you know everyone is going through the same.
Yeah. Well, we're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll continue these follow-up conversations, including a conversation about recovery from the big Mexico City earthquake this summer. We also want to hear from you, our listeners. Have you or your loved ones been trying to recover from natural disasters this year? Is there an untold story that you don't think people are seeing and hearing? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. 235-2888. I'm Brian Ellison, Central Standard. We'll be right back. It's KCUR Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Gina Kaufman today. And we're talking about Kansas Cityans who are watching from afar as their homelands or hometowns recover from natural disasters, the hurricanes and earthquakes that made big news this summer, but from which many in the media have moved on. Jose Marti is here, who is from Puerto Rico, still has family there. So is Amy Duke. She grew up in Houston. We'll continue with them in a moment. We also want to hear your stories of loved ones recovering from this year's disasters. Give us a call at 816-235-2888. First joining us, though, by phone is Cielo Fernandez. And Cielo, welcome back to Central Standard.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you for having me, even at the distance.
Yes, we appreciate you joining us by phone. Last time you were with us was about 12 weeks ago, and that was just after the magnitude 7.1 earthquake that hit Mexico City.
Right.
That earthquake, we would eventually learn, killed about 370 people. 6,000 people were injured. Remind us what family you still have in Mexico City.
Well, I think pretty much all of my family. In fact, I think I'm the only one who lives outside Mexico. So pretty much all my family lived in Mexico. Some of them were medium shaken and others a little bit more shaken. Have a couple of cousins that lost their house. I mean, luckily the buildings didn't collapse, but they were not allowed to go back to the house. So they're still in the issues of recovering. I mean, they have been organizing like one by one, all the people who live in the buildings, they have to go in, take out all their stuff. Mm-hmm. They don't allow more than one person by time because, you know, the structure is very, they don't know what can happen if they can collapse in a minute.
Wow.
That has been hard. It has been hard for them.
Mm-hmm. A lot of what you shared last time with us was reflecting on your own experience back in 1985 when the even more devastating earthquake hit.
Yeah.
As you think back to the recovery after that event, how have these last few months compared?
Well, I think that, as I mentioned in that time, I think that the big, big, big difference is the number of dead people, because since 85, everybody in Mexico City learned to do something when the earthquake was coming. So that effort prevents a lot of deaths. I mean, only 370 is nothing compared with the thousands that we have in 85. So that was a great, great positive thing. Now, this has been a generation without any earthquake of this magnitude. So I think that this move, a lot of the younger people, the millennials, let's say, people that were a little bit more in the negative feeling, like, I don't care about the city, I don't care about the government, you know, all these young people that are angry with everything, they shake them pretty well. So maybe, I don't know if that's good. I mean, if they don't lose their lives or somebody close to them, they're happy. I mean, they now have a purpose in life.
Mm-hmm.
They are finding that unity is wonderful.
Has your family been able to, for the most part, recover, or are they still dealing with the repercussions of what happened?
Well, as I said, I mean, my house, for example, it's repaired. It's been repaired. Interesting, the house of my family house where my grandparents used to live, we just sold that house this year, earlier in the year. And next day of the earthquake, the new owners put a sign of for sale. So they didn't like to live there. That house was next to a very tall building that didn't collapse, but shake very, very hard. So they're not happy about that. The rest of the family, except of these two cousins that lost they cannot go back to their homes. Everybody is pretty much fine. But in Mexico City, the resilience is pretty fast, and just as your other guest mentioned, it's such a big city that the cleaning was very fast. It was taking over the government. Now the rebuilding, that's another thing, because that's taking over the owners of the buildings. some of them. It's not as prevalent as in here to have an insurance. So some of the new condos were insured, so they had insurance, so maybe the rebuild will be less painful. But for a lot of people, there's no option of rebuilding. So I have been listening to the news, and the government claim that they are putting a lot of money, but in essence, they don't see the money. I asked my friends and my family what's going on, and they said, well, when now they have empty land for the some building collapse, and the empty land maybe will be there forever.
Well, Cielo, we appreciate you sharing an update on how your family's doing, and we'll continue to think about you as you experience all this from afar.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me. Good to hear from everybody.
That's Cielo Fernandez. Her family's in Mexico City, where they're still recovering from a major earthquake this summer. Let's get back to our guests, Jose Marti and Amy Duke. Jose, your family in Puerto Rico obviously survived the hurricane there. Not everyone was so fortunate, but there's actually been a lot of conversation about the death toll that's been reported by the government. Government still is at the number 55 deaths as a result of the hurricane, but some researchers say that number may actually be as high as 1,000 or more people, especially as there continues to be a longer and longer period where electricity is limited or clean water isn't available. Have your family members lost people close to them?
Not personally, not close friends or people that we knew. What we know about the death toll is that since everything, I mean, the infrastructure, the communications broke down, it is really complex. Because what is going to be a normal, I'm going to say, death is typically handled by the local funeral home, which in this case, they were not operating. There's no way to call them. Mm-hmm. So the family members are people who passed during the event by any reason. Some of them, they had to bury them in the backyard, right?
And those aren't being counted anymore.
Those are not counted. And then the state office have to start the investigation, right? And so they have people going around the island trying to find out. And if a lot of them were probably put as for natural causes by the local hospital, we're never going to know the number. But we know it's not 55. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's going to be as close as 1,000, but and you get information from friends who probably know a little bit more. It's north of 150 or 100, that's for sure. But it's going to be really hard. I'm not sure what is behind not going deeper into the real number, but we know that it's probably not 55.
And that shapes how people perceive the seriousness of the event, how many deaths are attached to it. And you know, to that end, Amy, let me ask you, I mean, the devastation in Houston was incredibly severe for a major American city, and yet people mention it in the same breath as Hurricane Katrina and the impact on New Orleans and the number of lives lost there. And somehow this ends up feeling like Hurricane Harvey is a smaller story. How do you get people to recognize the seriousness of something that has been such a life changer for your family?
Well, I think one difference between Katrina and Harvey is the government's short-sightedness and immediate efforts. And that didn't happen
so much.
Do you
feel like the
Harvey.
Government response was better to Hurricane Harvey?
The government, from the local to the national level, I think was better after Harvey. I think there were some big lessons to be learned from Katrina. And it's a different city with different dynamics.
But it still felt like the attention being given to Houston was it sufficient in your view? Are people still paying attention enough as they should, or is it okay that people are kind of moving on?
I think it's hard to judge because I'm so closely paying attention that I don't know what other people are noticing. So it's on the front of my mind. But I think this was distinct too, that there were two other major storms that happened immediately after Harvey that consumed the news. And there are so many other headlines that a year or two or three ago we were not accustomed to.
Let's take a call at 816-235-2888. Let's talk to Lori in Overbrook, Kansas. Hi, Lori.
Hi.
So you were your family was affected by Hurricane Harvey in Houston?
My husband's cousins live in Houston, and they live on a small farm, and they lost, besides animals and some of their household belongings, one of the boxes that they lost was all the children had made handmade ornaments over the years, and for their Christmas tree. And I noticed a Facebook post that they had for the weekend. All the kids came back, and they just had an ornament-making party and made her a bunch of handmade Christmas ornaments to put on her tree again.
Yeah, so out of a tragedy, at least a little glimmer of hope and joy.
Yes, yeah.
Lori, thanks so much for sharing that.
Thank you.
You know, I know that loss of a box of Christmas ornaments is not nearly on the scale of people who've lost their homes or people who've lost their lives, and yet those things do matter, right? These memories, these connections to family and to the past. Do you feel like in the case of your families that you've lost some of those things, Jose?
For the most part, I would say would be the memories that happen at places that are not going to look the same. Right, as you start looking back, and we're talking about you had a short clip or audio about the El Portal, El Yunque. So you know, you start thinking, is it going to be the same? Are we going to have rainforest back?
This is a very popular tourist area as well in Puerto Rico, the El Yunque rainforest.
Yeah, and you're only, I mean, it sounds a little bit selfish because you're thinking about your memories, but it is the economy, right? It is part of the economy. People go there just to enjoy the nature, and kind of from there, every day, every week is a little bit of a different reflection or looking at what is going to happen. And one of the things that I know it happened is that the Hurricane Maria kind of lifted what I'm going to call the green blanket of poverty. It was hitting in the high regions, in the mountains, and now we know that it was there and it's been there all along. And now we know that it was probably bad. It's been a long problem in Puerto Rico, but now we know because we don't have the green blanket, I'm going to call it, to cover those houses that were not in great shape as the one in the city in San Juan or in the major towns.
Yeah. Are there untold stories that the two of you know about that you think we have missed that people, what would you want people to know about what's happening now, 10, 12 weeks later in Houston, Amy?
Well, I think one thing that was surprising to me is thinking about the fact that my grandmother's life has become this open book to family members, but also to strangers. I mean, the number of volunteers who came in to help pack up 52 years of possessions was several dozen. Hmm. And so we actually, when she and my cousin, who also lost her home, moved into this rental house recently, we had to repack everything because some of the boxes had collapsed due to the moisture. There were a few boxes that had wet stuff in it that someone mistakenly packed. There's this open book quality, but also, you know, her finances become an open book. And she has three kids and eight grandchildren all telling her what to do and urging her to make decisions that she's not ready to make. And so I think the added stress of all of these new bosses to her life that she's led independently for so long is something that I hadn't really considered. So I'm trying to be a little more sensitive to that.
Which I know from having an aging grandmother myself, they're not always thrilled with that development.
Right. She's handling it very gracefully, but
yeah,
it's got to be challenging.
Jose, what story do you think people are not necessarily paying attention to that they should be?
I'm going to say, I agree with you. When you start kind of try to talk to, especially your parents or I'm going to say elderly people in your family, because everything is out an open book. It is difficult. But the untold story for me of the recovery in Puerto Rico has been the actual local communities, people that took everything they had that wasn't much to clean the roads, take debris out of their streets, even... you know, YouTube has been a great resource because in the breakdown of communications, people who had access to internet, they were broadcasting, right? And there was this great clip about a local community organization taking food to this devastated community. You can see the house was pretty bad. And the owner says on video, you know what? I'm okay. I have food for like a couple more days, but I know there is a couple up the hill and they don't have anything and we can't get over there. If you could, you know, because we're a little bit elderly, if you can like climb over this area and hike over there, I know they need food. That is the untold story of the recovery.
Very quickly, one other question for you, Jose. You mentioned that your family has, some of your family has moved to Maryland and some are still in Puerto Rico. A lot of people are leaving. There have been reports of maybe 100,000 people moving to Florida. Potential impact on political campaigns and who knows what else in the future. But I guess I'm curious, what's the impact going to be on Puerto Rico if tens of thousands of people leave and don't come back?
And that's going to be the biggest challenge, right? And Puerto Rico had decades when this happened economically, when people left. And we know that like the Puerto Rican community in New York is huge, but that happened in the 50s and 60s. Mm-hmm. For me, the biggest one is going to be education, right? That is the University of Puerto Rico future is uncertain right now, which I'm a product of. And I would say that's the biggest challenge, because if you don't have a future for the kids and the teenagers growing up to know they're going to have education, higher level education, and probably after that, you know, an economy where they're going to work, you know, pharmaceuticals, I don't know if they're going to reopen. Agriculture, it is estimated that the next harvest of coffee is not going to be in 2 years, right? Minimum. Wow. Plantains, bananas, minimum 10 months. So even TV stations, they're not running their shows because there's no one to watch them, right? So it is large-scale ripple effect through the society, and it's really hard to know if it's going to come back 100%.
We will keep following that story. We hope you will help us do that. Jose Marti, whose family is from Puerto Rico, and Amy Duke, who has family in Houston. Thanks to both of you for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us, Brian.
And when we come back, we'll talk with some other Kansas Cityans who have close ties to faraway countries, connections that those countries have recognized by granting them special status. We'll meet some of our city's honorary consuls when KCUR Central Standard returns. I'm Brian Ellison. Stay with us. You're French, and you've gotten yourself in a little bit of trouble here in Kansas City. Sitting in your jail cell, to whom should you make that one telephone call? Or you're a company in Wichita that sells a lot of product to South Africa. Who can you turn to locally to help navigate the messy matters of trade and taxes? I'm Brian Ellison, in for Gina Kaufman today on Central Standard. Kansas City doesn't have embassies or even official consulates for all but one country, that's Mexico. But perhaps you didn't know that more than a dozen countries have honorary consuls here, official representatives to help with situations like these and more. Here's the thing, though, they're Americans. They just really want to help. So here to tell us more about this are two of those honorary consuls. First, Cyprien Simkovitz, Honorary Consul of the French Republic for Kansas and Western Missouri. Welcome to you, Cyprien.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's great to have you here. And have you ever actually gotten a call from jail like that?
Actually, not from jail, okay. But from one of my bosses in Chicago who had gotten a call like that.
Interesting.
Yes.
So you have dealt with that. Well, we'll follow up on that. And also, Liebert D. Schultz, who's Honorary Consul for the Republic of South Africa. Welcome to you, Lee.
Thank you.
It's very nice to have you here. So I want to ask, what do you actually do as an Honorary Consul? Lee, what's one of your jobs?
Well, there is in the Vienna Convention on Consular Relations a pretty good list of consular functions. They start out with trying to promote trade, promote educational exchange, cultural exchange. You're representing the country and promoting the country where possible. I do little things like when ordering wine in a restaurant, you ask, "Do you have some South African wine?" but also to follow back up with the comment that Cyprien made, you're not going to get the call from jail. The treaty provides that law enforcement in the United States is going to call the closest consulate or the embassy and say, okay, we've detained a South African or a Frenchman, and they're obliged to do that.
And so we're both of you, the closest consulate is in Chicago, is that right?
Yes.
That's correct.
And so Cyprian, you get a call from the consulate in Chicago. What are you supposed to do about that here?
Well, first I want to say that the primary duty of an honorary consul or consul is to represent and protect the interest of the citizens of the sending country, in my case, France. So when I get a call like that, usually what they ask me is a list of criminal lawyers in the area. One of the calls I got was regarding a person who had been arrested and detained by the immigration authority as well as by the criminal authority of the state. So there were two issues there. So, of course, there were immigration lawyers involved and criminal lawyers involved.
You know, I think we hear the term honorary consul, and that might create the impression that that means ceremonial, that there's no real job here. But you actually have some really important official duties.
Right. It means no money.
Right. Honorary means you're unpaid.
Exactly. We do that for the glory and for service, you know.
Well, and so how did you end up doing this? Let me start with you, Lee. How in the world did you as an American become honorary consul for South Africa?
Well, I, as a corporate attorney, one of the projects I undertook was buying a coal mine in Swaziland. Swaziland's very small, and so I would have to go to South Africa next door to get things done. And I was impressed with what I saw, and certainly what has happened there in the last 20 years has been very, very interesting. And so I thought, well, that'd be a good retirement activity.
So you don't have family there, you don't have heritage with South Africa, but you traveled there for work and you really admired the place.
Yes, exactly. Admiration and respect for the place. And how do you become honorary consul? I went to the embassy and spoke with them and no one seemed to be interested. I went to Chicago, spoke with the Chicago consulate, the consul general and the trade representative. And very quickly, I found myself appointed. And every country is going to be a little different on how they want to approach the subject. Some countries probably don't want honorary consuls. Other countries would probably be thrilled to have someone express an interest because you do quite a bit to represent the country.
Yeah. Cyprian, how did you end up in the job?
Well, I had been living here for quite a while. As you can hear, perhaps I'm not from here. I'm east of here, but across the big pond. And I had been in my capacity as president of another cultural organization called the Alliance Française de Kansas City. I had been already helping the general consulate. So when time came to appoint a new person, they asked me, and of course I said yes. How do we get appointed? But first, you have to be approved by the French government, in my case. And then you also have to be approved by the U.S. Department of State. So it took a while because, of course, they have to make all kinds of verifications and so on. But it happened.
I'm curious, how official is your standing as a diplomat? Are you empowered in the ways that other diplomats are to get involved in situations? Do you get diplomatic immunity if you get a parking ticket while you're doing this work?
Emphatically, no.
Good to know.
No. Well, actually, it's interesting because consuls, even regular consuls, are not really diplomats, but the ambassador and his staff are diplomats. But we get the same, some kind of the I wouldn't say benefits. So we are in a way considered diplomats. We have a card from the U.S. State Department, and it says diplomat.
In fact, but, I see that that Lee has his right now.
Right. So, you know, we have limited, in that capacity, we have limited immunity, but only regarding performance of our duties as honorary consul, which Lee has listed.
So Lee, tell me about the rest of the group. How long have you been doing this, I guess?
About 12 years.
So you've gotten to know other honorary consuls in Kansas City from other representing other countries.
Absolutely, and there is an organization of those honorary consuls. It's called the Consular Corps, and we will meet for lunch during the year, of course, get to know the other honorary consuls.
And do you all have very similar functions, or are there different things in your different portfolios?
Each, I think probably each honorary consul approaches it in his own way. The treaty, the Vienna Convention on Consular Relations, is a general guide as to your functions and what you should be doing. But each of us, I'm sure, has their own specific interests in the consulate for whom you report, I guess. I'm sure has different thoughts as to what is important to them.
Cyprian, when you think back to kind of the experiences you've had, now how long have you been doing this?
Well, I have been doing that officially since June 2014.
Okay, so a few years now.
A few years.
What's one of the most memorable experiences you've had doing this work?
Well, actually, last April, we had a big commemoration of the centennial of the U.S. entry into World War I.
Right, with the National World
National
War I Museum.
National World War I Museum and Memorial, with whom, with which we collaborate a lot. And it's part of our duties, you know, cultural activities, exhibitions, events. And I was responsible for choreographing and putting all this together on behalf of the French Republic. So we had the French ambassador here. We had three French senators. We had a whole slew of French representatives. So that was the most memorable thing, yes.
That must have been very exciting for you to be interacting with government officials.
Absolutely. I mean, I think being an honorary consul, and especially in my position, France in the Midwest is responsible in Chicago for 13 states in the Midwest, but we have 10 honorary consuls. France likes to have a big diplomatic representation. So it's very thrilling to meet all those people, to help them. And of course, in April, we had the French Air Patrol who, you know, flew twice over the Liberty Memorial.
Yes.
And so we met them. I mean, it was great. Yes.
How many South African honorary consuls are there around the United States?
Around the United States, I think it's probably five or so.
So this is not all that common. Kansas City is fortunate to have one.
Well, interesting, some of the consuls have jurisdictions that are described as, quote, the American Midwest, end quote, which I think would be, good heavens, you get a call from your consul general saying there's somebody with a problem in Nevada.
which is not so close.
No, my jurisdiction is Kansas and Missouri.
But sometimes it happens.
It happens that you end up having to help someone further.
It happens if they're in, let's say, northern Oklahoma or Arkansas, since, you know, are probably closest.
Yeah. How many people are there, do you know, in Kansas and Missouri who are South African?
I think in Kansas City there's maybe a couple hundred.
So it's not a huge expatriate population here.
No. Of that couple hundred, there's maybe 150 that are really interested. We will have activities during the year, and a goodly number of that 150 will be interested in showing up.
And there are a few more French citizens in the Kansas City metro area?
We estimate not everybody is registered at the General Consulate in Chicago. Nobody has an obligation to do that. But we estimate that multiplying the numbers, there's probably 10 times the population that Lee mentions. Yes, yes. And I must say, the ironic thing is here today is that my father was brought up in South Africa.
Oh.
So actually...
So you may need to consult Lee
yes,
if you
yes,
get in trouble.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Well, very good. I am curious. You've mentioned that, yes, you are available if someone gets in legal trouble or something, but a lot of what you do is represent the country to Americans. You've talked about promoting trade, about sort of educational opportunities. I'm curious how exactly you do that. I mean, these countries have tourism budgets. They have people who work professionally full time on educational exchanges. What do you do as a local person to do that, Cyprien?
Well, if they have a special project, if Chicago has a special project, they contact me, and we find partners here. We partner with a university. We just did actually a few weeks ago with a French history scholar and historian who gave a presentation at Park University and as well a public presentation at the World War I Museum. So we find partners, the Nelson Atkins Museum, for instance, in cultural or other universities. Académie Lafayette, who is the only full French immersion school in the area and is in path of becoming probably the first one in the United States. So we find partners all over the place.
Lee, apart from asking about South African wines on local restaurant menus, how else do you promote South African business here?
We've had trade meetings in Wichita, where we took the ambassador to Wichita, and he toured several aircraft manufacturers and other companies in Wichita. And I think when he looked at the map originally, he thought, good heavens, what can be in Wichita? Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, having met with Learjet, Spirit Aviation that manufactures for Boeing and others, his head was spinning, realizing what was here. And then in the evening, he spoke to a meeting of the World Trade Council of Wichita. And I should mention that UMKC sends an exchange group of students to South Africa every year. The original relationship exists between MU and Columbia, mm-hmm. in Columbia, and the University of the Western Cape. And that started before the end of apartheid.
So there's a history of those connections here.
Oh, yes. And it's that relationship with MU has continued and grown.
Yeah, I want to ask both of you. You both have the Consul General in Chicago that you sort of report to. What does that person do other than get a paycheck that you don't? I mean, are you really doing the same work just on a voluntary basis here in Kansas City, or is there does the consul, like the Consul General of Mexico, who is here, do they have a little more on their plates, Cyprien?
Well, I would presume to be like our new consul general just took his function at the end of August. I think they supervise all these domains of activity, but for 13 states,
yeah.
Basically.
So it's
a
the
big,
foot
big,
soldier.
Big,
for...
We are a foot soldier, absolutely.
Well, it sounds like a very exciting, very interesting, very engaging volunteer opportunity, and a unique one. And I'm pleased for you both, and thank you so much for taking a few minutes to be with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Lee Schultz, who is the Honorary Consul for South Africa, and Cyprien Simkovitz, who is the Honorary Consul for France, both of them here in Kansas City. You can listen back to this show, including our earlier conversation about ongoing disaster recovery as experienced by Kansas Citians from afar. That's at kcur.org/centralstandard. Don't forget, you can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCURCST, and I'm at PTS Brian. Tomorrow on the program, what's the deal with those Parks Department parcels that Kansas City voters always have to vote on selling off? We'll find out. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Coy Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan, with help from intern Tom Taylor. Gina Kaufman's back tomorrow. I'm Brian Ellison. Stay tuned now for Up to Date, coming up next.